Greetings, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Casterbrus podcast. Yes, with a K. Available on Casterbrus.com, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and audio boo. It all started as a mild curiosity by these Casterbrites, and now it's turned into quite a spirit of adventure, don't you think? Listen.
Oh, there's a bloke over the road, I swear. He's wearing a white and green sort of tracksuit hoodie top. If it had a little bit of... If it had a big red spot on one side and three smaller lozenge-shaped buttons on the other, he would look like Buzz Lightyear.
Ah. Oh. Go and let him know.
No, it's too far away now. I've got a podcast to record. Ladies and gentlemen, a big thank you to the Doctor who's taken the time to record us a couple of intros for the podcast. We were thinking of asking John Guiler to do it, but they just weren't up to scratch. Whereas when you've got the Doctor to do it, then obviously they're perfect.
I really love John. There's a YouTuber of John with the Cyberman toy.
Oh, yes.
That one. Mm-hmm. I had that one. You've got to put that in the show notes because I think that's one of the funniest things he's done.
Okay.
I love that. That
I'm sure he'll be delighted to learn that's the funniest thing he's done. But...
Ever, yeah. Ever. Everything else disappointed me, but that was just a little better than the disappointment of it otherwise. No, I love that one. I just think it's everything about it just works. It's a great little 50 seconds.
Now, John is going to come back on the podcast in the near future once the Amazon TV version of Contradiction is out and ironed out and working
good
for people. So that would be great to have him back on. I don't know who's going to be on with. We'll sort that out later. He might be on his own. He might be with a friend or co-star. I don't know. We'll sort that out as we go. And we'll let you know closer to the time. We've got a couple of more guests lined up in the near future as well. James doesn't know about this yet because I haven't had a chance to talk to him about it. But that's a bit of a change for the monotony even of the James McLean, Christian Corley, Brian Terranova triumvirate of madness.
God, yeah.
There's no Brian this week, sadly, due to adverse weather conditions in the United States of America. He's not affected directly by the weather. The fact that other people are means that he has to do things he doesn't want to do, like work. So... If you are one of Brian's friends, and I know there's lots of people who know Brian who tune in, he's not here this time, but perhaps if you go and give him a wave while he's working there at the dental place, he'll wave back.
Yeah, maybe. Can you pop to the dental place in America and just go and see Brian? I'm sure that's a stone's throw for most of you out there.
Love is you're specifically speaking to the ones who know Brian quite well, yeah. And know where he works. Not Eric from Oregon. Eric, if you're listening, I didn't know he existed until just now. So,
right.
He just dropped his cup. They mentioned me! Yeah, sorry, Eric. I've just created you. It's like that film with... who's in that film? Will Ferrell and Emma Thompson. It's like that.
Will Ferrell?
Yeah.
He's in that film.
And Emma Thompson, yeah. She's in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's that, yeah, they're in that film with Will Ferrell and Emma Thompson.
That's right.
Yeah.
Speaking of films in a kind of a roundabout kind of way, and nothing to do with Doctor Who, I was at a party yesterday, and it was a children's party, and it was Frozen-themed children's party, but it took place in a church hall. Because lots of things like that in the UK, they happen in church halls, and maybe that's the same way you are in your part of the world. And often in the UK, they take place in social clubs and end up in fights. So my family's a little bit more reserved than that, so we do things in church halls. But the fighting is usually restricted to whether...
Get to the point!
Someone's took change out of the charity dish. Anyway, and I got myself a copy of Stephen King's On Writing.
Right, okay.
For 30 pence.
And it's at the party?
Yeah.
Right, so they were selling
it. It wasn't part
things.
Of the party. It was, you know, it was just like a sort of, it's there permanently as a fundraiser for the church.
Right, I see.
I got a copy of that for 30 pence. This is one of the most significant books written and published on writing, hence the title. And I got it for 30p. I'm quite chuffed about this.
Good. That's a bargain.
Yeah, it is a bargain.
You didn't have it before?
No, I've never had it, no. That's why I bought it.
Despite it being one of the most vital books for writers.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Huh.
Yeah. Well, you know, as you know, the vast majority of my writing, probably something in the realm of 99% of my writing, is not creative. It is news and tutorial based.
Hmm.
Which is why, you know, I've been over the years been putting off the kind of any kind of aspirations I might have into the you know, the fiction areas, you see. That's a putting off that ends this year. So Doctor Who.
What about it?
Great news today. Did you see this about Big Finish and UNIT?
Yes, I did.
This is interesting. This is significant in some interesting ways, because I find the touchscreen on my monitor stopped working, so I'm going to have to start going back to the mouse. Is that Gemma Redgrave is starring with Big Finish, or for Big Finish, in UNIT Extinction as Kate Stewart. Now, we have probably spoken about this in the past, that we kind of think that there's a good chance that Big Finish might start doing more post-2005 style Doctor Who. And although they were co-producing on the Destiny of the Doctor series in 2013, which were kind of like companion chronicle style audiobooks, this is their first, do correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty certain I'm not, this is their first post-2005 era Doctor Who. And although there's no Doctor in it, there is UNIT, and there's a modern Doctor Who creation, Kate Stewart, although of course she does predate 2005 Doctor Who. I'll maybe get into that later. But it is good news, and it perhaps does let us dream a bit that Big Finish can be bringing us audios of 9, 10 and 11, and maybe even the War Doctor. Or War 10 and 11, and maybe even the Ninth Doctor might have been a better way of putting that. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. Be interesting to see what they do with UNIT. While we've also got the Brigadier production working alongside doing other sort of not quite yet UNIT adventures. The Earth-based aspect of Doctor Who is getting a bit of a fanfare this year.
Yeah.
But no, it is interesting, as you say, because there has always been that sort of almost like apartheid between old and new so far as what Big Finish was able to do. So this sort of breaks that quite significantly.
Era apartheid.
Yeah, I know. It's not very good, though, is it? It feels a little too political still to use that.
Yeah, we'll overlook that. Did you know, though, because you mentioned the Colonel Lethbridge Stewart series.
I did.
I'm in the middle of taking notes for a review of Andy Frankham Allen's first instalment in that run, Forgotten Son, and so I've got review copy, and it really does feel like a new adventure. I don't know whether it's this is obviously an intention to sort of like appeal to those of us who read the new adventures, as we discovered when we spoke to Andy and Sean and Hannah a few weeks ago. It does have the feel of a new adventure, and I know that there is an intentional aspect to that to appeal to new adventures readers. But also there's that thing, you remember with the new adventures when they came out, when you first discovered them, like, you were kind of having to evangelize because no one else knew about them. And at the same time, there was that thrill of that no one else knew about them. So you kind of had a secret Doctor Who all to yourself that was fantastic, but other people didn't know about it. There's an aspect of that to it. And that might be just because it's a review copy. But it's difficult to say, really. But I am excited by it. I'm really looking forward to writing the review. It's so far, it's very enjoyable indeed. So it does seem to be kind of a unit-tastic year, doesn't it? 2015.
I know.
Timey-wimey.
Who'd have thought?
Yes, yes.
Yes, awkward.
Who would have thought? Especially after I kind of think as well that the Colonel stuff's come along at absolutely the right time, because I mean, I'm still kind of smarting over Cyberbrig.
Uh-huh.
And I think both of these can, in their own way, perhaps, I don't know, soothe the jarring nature of it. I mean, to be honest with you, I don't know what kind of interaction isn't the right word at all, but what sort of coverage the new Big Finish series will give to events in Doctor Who. So I wouldn't be surprised to find out that they've mentioned it. I really don't think they would dare contradict it while Stephen Moffat's writing. In charge of Doctor Who, anyway.
Yeah. I wonder why it's... What, do you think UNIT is getting more popular? Do you think UNIT in the new series is popular? I mean, UNIT in the new series is sort of slightly ambiguous. Maybe it needs a Big Finish to give it some...
Identity?
Identity, yeah.
Yeah.
Because I don't know whether I'm meant to like it, admire it, hate it, care for it at all.
Hmm.
It's... And I don't think they've really done enough with her as well to make her particularly engaging, which is, again, something which I don't think has anything to do with the actress, or even perhaps the character, it's just time.
Yeah.
Maybe, again, that Big Finish will be able to give her some exploration and strengthen her for viewers when she does reappear inevitably in one of the future series.
Well, it needs something, and you know, if they are going to continue with UNIT, as you suggest, then it does need to somewhere to breathe. Although obviously the shortcoming with that is that not everyone's going to get the experience of hearing it breathe.
No, absolutely.
Now the interesting thing about Kate Stewart is that she's not a Stephen Moffat character. So if any of you out there were under the impression that Kate Stewart exists purely in new Doctor Who, post-2005, or indeed post-2010 in the Stephen Moffat era, you would in fact be quite mistaken. Would they not, James?
You are referring to the sort of video stuff.
Indeed, in the I am.
1990s, I guess. Was it or late 80s?
Yeah. It was Downtime I was thinking of specifically.
Yeah.
Which was a 1995 direct-to-video production, featured... It was directed by Christopher Barry, and Liz Sladen was in it, along with Deborah Watling and Jack Watling. And so that's... that's that. That's Victoria Waterfield, who's in there. And Ander Brigg was in it. Nicholas Courtney was in it as well. And his daughter, Kate, who was played by a quite different actress. And you'll forgive me for forgetting. There's a lady called Beverly Cressman.
Right.
Who has since done some Big Finish.
Oh. Good thing to do, you know. They've just done... They're doing a UNIT adventure, did you know?
Are they really?
Yeah, apparently so. I'm not sure, but it's got a new character, Kate Stewart. I think she was created by Stephen Moffat.
No, she wasn't.
Wasn't she? No, oh, right.
No. It's one of those crazy Casterbus time loops.
Yeah.
Do you remember when we used to do that thing, when we used to do next week on last week's podcast?
Yeah.
Was it last week on next week's podcast?
I can never remember.
No, I can't either. Whose idea was that, James?
It was mine.
It was a bugger to produce, wasn't it?
It was, and no one remembered. No one commented on it. No one liked it, and no one has ever asked for it to come back.
Indeed. Apart from maybe me once, when I had a couple of afternoon sherbets. Listen, you know that Christopher Eccleston?
Yeah.
He's a real bastard who hates Doctor Who fans.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
So says some elements of fandom, none of which I believe. I'm certainly not in my as far as I'm concerned, that's not the truth. I don't think James would agree with that either.
Absolutely not.
I'm certain Mr. Terranova would disagree wholeheartedly. So it was with delight that we saw an old video clip. It turns out it's about a year old, of Christopher Eccleston helping out with a wedding proposal in the New York area while he was in the United States filming The Leftovers. And now, I'm pretty certain there's an awfully good chance that you, as a Casterbus listener and presumably reader most, at least some of the time, have seen this clip. It has proved to be our most popular article since probably 2013, actually. It's been it's had something like 100,000 views.
Do you know who hasn't looked at the article?
No. You?
Yeah.
Oh, right, okay. It's always you. It's always you.
I don't see why people are interested in it. I mean, I always thought it was pretty much catalogued that, by and large, that the issues Eccleston had was more on production side.
Mm. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But, you know, you get people who just ignore these things and make up their own minds about what's going on rather than looking at the facts.
Yeah.
And not listening to people. Now, you know, one of the things about Christopher Eccleston is the fact that he left Doctor Who after 1 year, yes, but he has never named names. He's never specifically said who it was he had a problem with, what the exact problem was. He's never mentioned names. And that is an unusually classy thing to do in this day and age. So that at least deserves some respect. And, you know, I don't think we'll ever find out what really happened, but to blame that one guy on, you know, what you perceive to have happened is wrong when we don't really know what happened.
Well, yeah, I mean, we obviously know there's loads of different stories or angles to the first series of all the issues that was going on there, and I don't think we would be wrong in saying there are issues. But generally speaking, the reasons that people hate Christopher Eccleston or see him as an anti-Doctor Who person aren't for any of those specific reasons that might have been going down at the time. More essentially, let's face it, because he left Doctor Who earlier than people would have liked, and a lot of people consider that, and the fact he doesn't do conventions and doesn't... I mean, I've seen that argued so many times. You know, who does he think he is not doing conventions? You know, we made him. You think, what, really? So he owes you now? You know, let's forget contracts, let's forget money. You're only doing it for the person sitting at home or in his attic. Yeah, it's just... It's that sort of thing that always annoys me. But yeah, anyway, no, it's good. Good on him. And I'm glad that people like a feel-good story like that and they're clicking it rather than some grumbling article, which I'm sure I've got involved in.
Have you?
I don't know. I normally end up getting involved in some argument and then thinking, oh, this is just not worth it.
Oh, okay. Well, I had to ban someone over the weekend as well.
Oh, did you?
Yes. For...
Confrontational
reasons.
Did he say that he thought Time of the Rani was the best one ever? And
no,
you just thought, God, that's ridiculous. What's ridiculous? Ridiculous that you ban him for that, or ridiculous of the notion that Time of the Rani is?
Both, obviously. Do you know another popular article on Casterbus of late?
Yeah.
And I'll let you guess. If you go to the Casterbus front page.
Right, okay, yeah.
While James is doing that, regular listeners may have noticed that we're attempting to do a kind of a free-form, less structured version of the podcast this week. You know, the way James and Brian do when I'm not here.
No, I've scripted mine. This is all scripted.
Oh, have you?
Wait, no, let me do it. This is all scripted. Sorry, I put a couple of periods in that line and I didn't really put it out anyway. And that bit wasn't quite as I put in the script, nor was that bit there, or this bit, and this bit.
Someone
stop me, thank you. Yeah.
If you pick an article, it's on the front page currently, you tell me which article you think is something like second or third most popular article on Casterbus over the past month.
Over the past month? Well, I'd naturally try and sort of go for are these five Doctor Who villains more powerful than the Daleks just because it's got the comments?
No.
I would think it is... and it's still on the front page.
Yeah.
I would like it to be the Russell T. Davis and Stephen Moffat debate.
All right, no, it's not that.
No, I didn't think it would be. It's not things like top five things the Master has done after the end of time.
No, it's not that, no. Can I put you out of your misery?
Yeah, please, yeah. He's getting bored.
It's the In the Shadow of the magazine.
You're joking.
I am not.
I don't believe that. That is just so annoying. It's been sitting in that magazine for, what, 2 years now?
Yeah.
You could have all gone out and bought it and then given us a little bit of compensation for our time. And no, you just wait till it gets free and you can put it on there. And that's the most popular.
Annoying, isn't it?
Typical. Absolutely typical.
Okay, so what do you think about this new Doctor Who comic?
I've never, as I've said before, I've never really liked Doctor Who in comic form. It's never really worked for me. Does it really work for you? Even when... does it work for you? I mean, I know, actually, you know, it does for you, because there's a couple that you will always...
Kind of post-New Who, it kind of hasn't worked so well. I think in the past 5 years, it's improved a bit. But there was definitely a period, sort of 2005 through to 2010-11, where... it wasn't reaching the heights that it reached prior to Doctor Who returning to TV. But this new Doctor Who comic, which is a UK publication, is essentially... it's like going back in time, because it's basically reprints of American imports.
Yeah, I figured
Which is what we used to buy in the 80s, isn't it? As comics. If you weren't buying 2000 AD or Beano Dandy, you were... 9 times out of 10, you were purchasing a comic which comprised of reprints of American comics.
And you still get a lot of that as well.
Do you?
Well, yeah, I mean, get a lot of the Marvel stuff is as compendiums.
Right.
You know, 2 years old from the States. So, yeah, it's still in a different sort of way, but I know what you mean, yeah.
Yeah. So it's quite strange that this should happen, and this happened because Titan doesn't have a UK licence for distributing Doctor Who, so they've had to get a new license with BBC Worldwide in order to repackage their comics for the 10th, 11th and 12th Doctors into new monthly comics, which will include each of the adventures of those Doctors.
What is quite interesting, I think, is the way that it's marketed over here, as it's marketed in a very typical British. It still feels like it's behind the times. It feels like it's like, well, this is aimed, you know, like 9-year-olds will buy this. And it has that sort of 9-year-old feel to the magazine cover.
While
in the States, you know, these things, when they distribute out as comics, actually have more of a sort of mass market feel to them, that a lot of people buy a Doctor Who comic. But here it is very much pitched at kids.
Is childish the right word?
Yes, I think so.
Okay.
Don't you think? In fact, I mean, they've not really got out of this sort of format for...
Well, I did think it did have a feel of Doctor Who Adventures about it.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. So, yeah, I appreciate what you're saying there. Yeah, definitely. And also, there is also... And I think we'll get Gareth on in the near future to talk about this, with his unique insights into the sort of Doctor Who comic areas. Because it is something that he's...
The Nymon guy?
The Nymon guy, yeah. It is something that he knows quite a bit about. And to talk about this, because, you know, it does have an impact on Doctor Who magazine in kind of a roundabout way.
Yeah.
There's a strip in Doctor Who magazine which people have been reading for the best part of, 35 years? 36 years this year? And to suddenly have a mass market competitor puts a bit of pressure on Doctor Who magazine.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it depends on how much people buy it specifically for the strip, and if they have a comic strip indulged elsewhere, would they negate? I don't think they will. I think that's probably why they're aiming this sort of more at younger kids, thinking that Doctor Who magazine will still cater for the more adult. Market. I don't know. It just irritates me a bit. It just looks disposable. I wouldn't buy it if I saw that. Not aimed at me.
No. But you know, there are 9-year-old Doctor Who fans, so let us not be absolutely judgmental about these things.
Of course not. But they'd have to be stupid by now, they wouldn't. They'd be great Doctor Who fans. I think Capaldi looks good on the cover. He seems to have come out best out of all three of them.
Well, when you're nine, you're probably the best Doctor Who fan in the world when you're nine, aren't you?
Oh, absolutely. And when you're 39 or 54, I think it probably ever changes judging from the internet. But at least at nine, you've got the validity to actually to be able to exist in the narcissistic ego that is the child, that you can believe that and not really know better.
Yeah. Yeah, you can kind of get away with that particular. Yeah. Yes, wouldn't disagree with that. Okay. Is there anything that you particularly wanted to talk about on this week's first podcast with the Cade, besides what we were originally going to talk about, which we've put off for Brian's absence?
Okay. I have two things I particularly want to talk about.
Could I have a drink while you're doing this?
Yep. Yeah, go on.
You can carry on then. Get the popcorn out.
Put your drink. No. Number one, I think is quite exciting. If we carry on the Big Finish thread, is the Sixth Doctor's last adventure being revealed. Mm-hmm. I think that's quite a sexy and quite a daring piece of fiction to do. And also acknowledging the fact that it's unlikely that the BBC will ever cover it. So why not sort of give his what would be his last adventures a little more significance, since he never got to do them on television. So I think that's a kind of wonderful thing. It's wonderful because you get you can bring the Valiard back. It's wonderful because you give Colin what he wasn't able to have, and I think people will be very excited by that, especially with the lineup in that series. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think that's pretty exciting. I know Brian would find it exciting if he was there. Yeah.
I'm quite intrigued by it myself.
Is it something that doesn't particularly interest you that much? I'm not being picky here. I'm just genuinely interested. As genuinely interested as I can be.
I'm quite interested in a lot of Big Finish, but usually I don't get the chance to listen to it. So
I know, that's
the scummy thing. I don't want to go OTT.
Yeah. True.
I have to give other people the horrendous task of reviewing Big Finish because I don't have time to listen to it.
That's a hard thing.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's like, I mean, I've got an Audible account, and, you know, the only things that get listened to it are Beatrix Bloody Potter. They're the only things in my Audible account that get listened to. There's nothing wrong with Beatrix Potter, don't get me wrong, but, you know, I don't want to be listening to Beatrix Potter when I'm on a long car journey. I want to be listening to Toby Stevens reading a James Bond story or something.
And thank you for the copious amounts of Big Finish you've sent me to review. No, it's fine. Want me to lay out a whole bloody magazine that goes nowhere and we have to put it on our website so people can read it for free? That's fine. Send that to James.
James, you can review a Big Finish any time you like. All you have to do is ask me.
Don't want to. Yeah, that'd be cool. And of course, Trial of the Valiard as well, connected to that. There's a nice review from Meredith, which is always worth reading. I do like it when we get reviews. It's a nice opinion. The other piece I thought was particularly nice too was the and I thought this was a genuinely really interesting piece, was Nick Kitchen's one on Russell T. Davis and Stephen Moffat's rather lively and cheeky debate over the Doctor's marriages, which I thought was just a really interesting little bit of sparring between the two characters. And by characters, I mean the writers rather than the characters being the Doctor. And the whole notion of this stems from the fact that End of Time suggests that the Doctor may have made Mary less than a virgin. And Moffat suggesting that he never, that nothing was consummated after the marriage through the Day of the Doctor. Mm. And the two of them fighting, well, not fighting, but it's more Moffat responding to Davis over this sort of issue, which is kind of funny, you know, like 10 years on. You wouldn't imagine having this debate 10 years ago. Certainly wouldn't have imagined it in 1996 when Doctor Who came back with McGann. Do you imagine having a conversation about the Doctor having sex with the Queen?
I don't need to imagine. I'm having it now.
Yeah, well, okay, that's a good point. I saved your brain the trouble of imagining something by telling you directly. But, you know, I mean, it's funny when you go back to 1996 and that very innocent kiss,
yeah,
which was at the time just exploded, you know, in fandom with fury. And now fandom is sort of reconciling these sort of things quite comfortably, really.
Well, fandom has changed, hasn't it? The entire dynamic has changed since 2005. And I think a good portion of
But there's still the Barkers, aren't we, as Nathan Turner used to call us.
Apparently so. But as he's not here, he can't call us that, so...
No. Yeah. That screwed him.
Yeah. That'll learn it.
Saying that, and I don't want to pick on anyone in particular, but because Brian has this same logic. One of the commentators, I'm not going to name because actually there's only two of us at the moment on that piece. His first line is, the first Doctor had a marriage with whoever was the grandmother of Susan, which we can say for sure was consummated. And I still like saying, well, no, you can't. you've just created facts out of thin air on a race that doesn't have a sort of historical history of marriage based on English culture. You know, I don't. Do you know what I mean? It's amazing how fans, and it is said in the most genuine way, and it's said, you know, I'm not taking the mick out of the poster. I mean, I'm glad that he's offered stuff into this conversation, but I think what I'm trying to say is very easy to argue on Doctor Who by actually adding often human social politics or you know, economics or whatever onto characters in a show which are meant to be alien. I always find that kind of weird. And no, we don't know how.
Well, it's
what
like
marriage
Time
is
Lord's
for
culture,
Time
Lord. Isn't it? Throughout Doctor Who, it swings from being hugely alien to being
absolutely, you know, yeah,
very domestic and very British, and then
totally
swings back off out in the other direction again.
Which is why you can totally understand why commenters would actually suggest that it would be very, because, you know, through the 80s, suddenly Time Lord seemed very human. In the 70s, you have one Time Lord thinking about getting close to Leela.
Yeah.
So you get all these sort of contradictory feels. I mean, it's something Cartmell said, wasn't it, that, you know, he kind of felt that Time Lord culture was destroying Doctor Who in the 80s.
Yeah.
And you needed to pull it back. And I still personally feel that whether he consummates with Mary or not is not the point. I still find the idea of Time Lords having a sort of like a structure of marriage, kids consummating after marriage or consummating to have children, or, you know, they may or they may not, but to actually try and sort of embed it in Earth culture just ruins it.
Yeah.
They're so much cooler, as we've said 1,000 times in this podcast, in the War Games, where they're just so almost godlike, so detached from imagining. You couldn't imagine any of those three wandering home and having a cup of tea in an IKEA room with a small, cheap fountain of 80s water bubbling in the corner. You know, you couldn't see it with Rassilon seals everywhere. Which, of course, by the time the 90s came on, that would have been the way it had been done. So it'd be a Rassilon seal coaster for their tea and Rassilon seal on their microwave plate going round. You know, that's how the 90s are. I mean, the Master's costume in the 96 movie is like, oh, how many Rassilon seals can I wedge on here? So, yeah, it is a confusing thing. But it's an interesting article, not because of the content, but more to actually see how Moffat and Davis spar with each other a little. I think that is fascinating.
It is. There's our friend the Grand Moff on Twitter said that what really upsets Russell T. Davis isn't that I've rejected his pitches, nor my Hugo awards, it's that I only communicate with him in the pages of DWM.
Which is probably quite true.
Indeed. Very... listen, we've chatted quite a bit, the pair of us. We've gone through quite a bit. Do you want to do some recommendations for this week?
Sure. Do remember that we are about 5 minutes under our current timeage because there might have been a minor hiccup.
Indeed, but the listener doesn't know that. So
no, he doesn't.
Well, they do now.
He does now.
Or she.
He thinks it's all over.
So who wants to go first on the recommendations, James?
Well, I'm just trying to think what I've been doing. I've been a bit of hodgepodging this of late. I mean, nice. I've started Ambassadors of Death.
All right.
And on the DVD. It sounds like going out on the Raz. I've been on the DVD. And I've only got through half of part one, which I don't know is a testament to the fact that I've quite enjoyed it, but also a testament to the fact that I seem to be distracted from it very easily. I do find it fascinating.
Ambassadors of Death is topical as well, isn't it?
What, because of UNIT?
No, because of the Mars rover, the old Mars rover being discovered.
And oh, right, yes. It's exactly why I was watching it.
Is it? Indeed, yes. Yeah. I thought it might have been.
The only thing that I was interested in thinking about when I was watching it was that whole idea of Torchwood again. Right. And, you know, whether the technology to take Britain off into space in the 70s/80s of Doctor Who was connected to a policy that started before their time through Torchwood, you know, that whole sort of intertextuality of canonicity.
Yeah. And what did you decide?
I decided I didn't really care, to be honest. It was a boring topic to be thinking about. But what I did find more interesting was that I had been reading about Patrick Troughton in a very good book by a guy called James Chapman, who is, I believe, is an academic at Leicester, and he did a very good book on Doctor Who, which is something into the vortex, because it's over the other side of my room, so I can't give you the title and plug it for him. But it's a very, very good book, as it sort of goes through the period of Doctor Who and some fascinating stuff. You know, so much about the origins of the series, how, you know, we always see, you know, how much we always say Sidney Newman was the grandfather of Doctor Who, and you look further into it and you see all these, I think we said before, all these explorations into science fiction, these surveys being done prior to Sidney Newman and Doctor Who, which pretty much are the foundations to Doctor Who, and not Sidney Newman really at all. And that's all explored in all the archive notes, which is very fascinating. And then obviously Patrick Troughton's era, which is so brilliant, and yet was doing so poorly at the end. And so when you watch Ambassadors of Death, you are really looking at it from that sort of point of view. You know, where was Doctor Who at this point? You know, how? And suddenly it seems so very fresh, Ambassadors of Death, when you think, wow, yeah, where the show had been going through Hartnell and Troughton. This is such a massive reinvention. It was really quite daring and bold. And that's pretty cool. The other thing I quite like in, I think it's in Chapman's book, is the way that he comments on some of those standard myths. The ones, you know, that things like the gunfighters was the lowest audience ever for Doctor Who, and yet it wasn't. And there's loads of little myths about, you know, what the historicals weren't popular. And yet, you look at the actual data, historicals were quite popular.
Yeah.
And there's loads of things in there. So maybe, yeah, if you can find James Chapman's book, it's a fascinating read. And Ambassadors of Death is also quite a good story too, if you could get past part one, I'm sure.
I'm sure most people can. It's got a good cast as well, Ambassadors.
I am being a bit smart about it. Ambassadors is a very good story, as we've said before. I think majority in that first series is really very good. It's very, very British science fiction. It's got that very cold aesthetic of British science fiction of the 70s,
yeah.
Very detached and brutal almost in its old way. So, yeah, it's a really good example of British science fiction. If you're an American thinking of visiting the dental practice where Brian is, stop thinking about that for a second. And if you've not watched that series of Doctor Who, that is an example of British science fiction. Not British dentistry, but British science fiction.
Okay.
What about you?
Well, fat face? Sorry, what did you call me?
Fat face.
Fat face?
Yeah.
Oh, dear. That's very nice. And, yeah.
Oh, right. So you're saying people with fat faces. That's derogatory, is it?
No, I'm saying I don't have a fat face.
Well, then you shouldn't be worried.
True, yes, indeed. Ah, okay. So, now a few weeks ago I was watching a show called Primeval.
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah, and I've got to the end of the second series of that, as you may recall, dear regular listener. Series 3 we'll be re-watching in the near future, but while we haven't been watching Primeval, I've been watching Blake 7.
Oh, good man. Bravo.
Hurrah! And yeah, so the first three episodes of Blake 7 have been enjoyed on an evening in the Casterbris Towers household. So that's The Way Back, Spacefall and Cygnus Alpha. They're all very good. They're all really, really good. And something that... I think this is probably one of those things that happens when you sit watching compilation episodes. And there was that... The old VHS videos.
Well, the painfully edited.
Yeah.
The beginning VHS.
Yeah, yeah. And you kind of lose yourself in what's an actual episode and what's not an episode. So I'd completely forgotten the fact that Blake 7 was like 50-odd minutes long.
Yeah.
Watching those and watching them in compilation form on Gold, I was thinking they were Doctor Who length.
Just to clarify to readers or listeners, hopefully listeners rather than readers, because you're going to have a hard time with this podcast if you're trying to read it. But in the
binary experts reading the podcast.
In the late 80s on VHS, on the budget range, well, actually, no, originally it wasn't on the budget range. They were bloody expensive. You could buy three VHS of Blake 7, and the first one had four episodes of Blake 7, which was the three that Christian's just described in the fourth one, which I think was Time Squad,
yeah.
And they were condensed down into about 2 hours, 30 minutes or something. So it's a sizable chunk out of four 50-minute episodes were ripped out of the final three. So, and when you grew up with those, and then they came out and edited, suddenly these episodes had just loads of material that you didn't see, because as you say, they're actually 50 minutes each.
Yeah.
Which is what we're referring to. They were edited so horrendously badly for VHS originally. It was, in a way, it was bad. In a way, it was kind of good because you got a TV movie out of it in a sort of sense. But Blake 7 is very much about pacing, isn't it? It's a very slow, methodical pace, which is very British science fiction and also very economical. So you don't have to keep jumping between scenes. And so they work best, I think, in their original 50-minute formats.
Yeah, I would say so, definitely. I like the way it develops as well.
Yeah,
I've been able to come to this kind of like not completely fresh, but with refreshment. You know, there's a lot of comedies out there that I watch over and over and over and over again, and then I can't go back and watch them because I know what
I know that feeling. Yeah,
40 Towers and Blackadder and various episodes of Funny Fools and Horses, joking apart things. So to come to something that I've watched and enjoyed but haven't watched to death, I'm coming at it quite freshly, and the way it develops quite slowly with I mean, it must have been quite shocking watching the first episode in 1978.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you're recovering from a hangover on New Year's Day. Because apparently it went out on the 2nd of January. And, you know, you've got this guy who's your hero, who's been accused of being a revolutionary. He's then fitted up as a child abuser.
Yeah.
And then the only people who believe him are murdered.
Yeah.
It's not Time in the Run, is it?
But it is very Ambassadors of Death in that same sort of very clinical, cold British aesthetic.
Hmm.
Very detached, almost, I don't want to say documentary because it isn't, but it has that sort of coldness to it. And it's funny, I always felt with Blake 7, the first series, I always felt like all the budget was spent on those first two episodes, because there's some lovely bits of model work and lighting and the likes in The Way Back. And then in Cygnus Alpha, you've got some great stuff with the London and the scale of the Liberator in that you never really get after that. It's giant, which people don't seem to realize. You know, it's bigger than the Enterprise, massive thing.
Yeah.
And so there's lovely work in those first two episodes. And then it starts to lose some of that production value as it goes on from there. But it's a brilliant series. It's a brilliant one.
Now, what do you think of Vargas in Cygnus Alpha?
Brian Blessed?
Yeah.
I'd like it when you refer to him as the character's real name. again, Brian Blessed is like Paul Darrow in the sense that, in a lot of ways, Cygnus Alpha is quite a cold and, again, quite a British aesthetic to it, which is given that bit of spectacle, really, by Brian Blessed.
Mm.
He brings something to it. I mean, it's that lovely little scene between him and Gareth Thomas, you know, where he's describing his world, which is actually a fairly dull idea, but he brings it to life, you know, with trinkets, like these. it's quite a good moment. But I think my favourite probably is, out of the three, I think I prefer the second one. I think it's the most interesting. Spaceball. First one's good, yeah. Right. But
Spaceball is good. Now the thing about Brian Blessed is, now I was speaking to someone years and years ago about Brian Blessed. I can't remember who it was I was speaking to, but it was someone who'd watched a bit of classic TV, but I generally can't remember who it was. But that the impression that I got from them that was Brian Blessed had never done anything like that type of performance on TV before Blake 7. Now I might be wrong, because he might have been in New Avengers and he might have done in that. But the impression I got from that person was this was the first time he'd done that Brian Blessed, you know, the quintessential Brian Blessed performance.
Yeah.
Was in Cygnus Alpha.
That could be quite likely.
Mm. So he's kind of basically built the majority of his career has been based on that performance.
Well, absolutely. I mean, before that, he was more of a Z-Car sort of guy, wasn't he? Yeah. It was, and then along comes, and he does. He used to play them quite heavy. I mean, even after that, you'd get ones like you do in. I can't remember whether he was in Minder or not, but that's.
Well, I think
sort
he was in.
Was he in Sweeney?
He might have been in Sweeney. Was he in Return of the Saint?
Not sure. He was definitely in the Sweeney, playing a heavy character, but nothing to the extravagance.
No.
As you say, because what he's known for essentially is Flash Gordon. That dominates his Blackadder and his, as you say,
King
Doctor Who and
everything.
But it's that Flash Gordon, which is, as you say, a template really comes from his work here. So Blake 7 is a... If you've not seen Blake 7... Especially if you're into Doctor Who, you should be watching Blake 7, because the parallels in production and in story is.
That's right.
And of course, the Big Finish. I've still got to listen to one of the Big Finish ones. I've downloaded one that I bought at January in their sale, which I've still got to. Blake 7 ones.
Right.
Which I've got to try out, but I'm told they're very good as well. So
I have to confess that I have found that Sally Nivette was an extremely attractive lady, wasn't she?
Oh, dear. Has one got a thing? I actually preferred Jan Chappell, strangely.
Right. Well, I haven't got that far yet, so...
only one really... episode to go.
Yes, I know. But I can't really comment on that with any kind of reliability. She was in Emmerdale as well, wasn't she?
Yes, she was.
Yeah, with a very broad Yorkshire accent.
And of course, Glynis Barber, who will be appearing shortly as a mutoid, before she becomes Sulin later, and then of course Jane.
Yes.
the show she'd like you to forget. Later on after that, of course, Dempsey Makepeace. It's a great series. I'm quite invested. I might have to get I've got the first two on box set. I used to have them all on VHS, but got rid of them. But the first two series, I think, are the best, definitely.
If you're a fan of Blake 7 already, there's a podcast. The first time we had John Garlow on the podcast, he tells an interesting story about Glynis Barber, doesn't he?
Oh, yes. Yes,
so
he did.
If you can, I'll put it in the show notes. You can go back and listen to that. It might make you chuckle. I'm watching Blake 7. So, lots of fun there. Now, the first series is... 13 episodes. So I've got another 10 to go before I'm forced to watch Series 3 of Primeval. So do pray for me.
God, yes.
in fairness, the third series of Primeval has got Jason Fleming in it. So
one other thing I did watch, which you might be interested in. I've only watched the first series of this, so no more, was Whitechapel. Someone gave me that for Christmas.
All right. The first series.
Yeah, they've done four, I believe.
Yeah. So that's the original.
Jack the Ripper. Yeah. It's the first one I've seen. So hopefully during the year I'll grab the next series as well.
Okay. So what did you think of that?
I really enjoyed it. It felt like a role reversed Life on Mars.
Yeah.
With the Gene Hunt, Sam Tyler inverted in hierarchy and ranking. It was really good. I really enjoyed it. It was nice to talk about ITV. It's nice to get something from the ITV sheds, which I actually really enjoyed, which is rare.
Yes, same here. I wonder, have you been watching Broadchurch?
I haven't this series. I watched the first series, but I just didn't have the incentive to watch the second. Have you been enjoying it? I've heard a lot of people enjoying it.
I find it as watchable as it was before, but you know, as watchable, I said. I did have alarm bells, but you know, because it's Monday evening, like 9 till 10 o'clock. In fact, when I watched the first episode, it was probably 10 till 11 o'clock because I watched it on Plus One. And I was kind of thinking there was something not quite right, and but you know, I didn't follow it up. And then I saw some posts on Facebook or wherever, and there was a link to, and the thing that I found that wasn't quite right was a legal aspect to it, because you know, the Charlotte Rampling's character plays the barrister for, I'm terrible with names in Broadchurch as well, Danny Latimer's family,
right,
and. There was something that didn't feel quite right. And, you know, later on, maybe last week or the week before, I found this link, so I read it, and apparently it's just chock-a-block with legal faux pas.
Oh, dear. Like
one example of something that's badly researched. It's as if Chris Chibnall's made everything up or has been watching a few episodes of Law & Order UK and decided that is the law and just, like, shoehorned them in. So that's quite unfortunate.
Well, given that he used to write for Law & Order UK, yes, I know. Would probably explain why. Yeah. Yeah. I see where you were going there. Fair enough. Yeah. Carry on.
And there's also the Eve Miles plot is kind of interesting. It's really the only thing that's keeping it going, to be honest with you, because the legal drama side of things is a little bit stuttery. So yeah, I mean it's watchable, but it's not as enticing or as enthralling as the first series, by any means.
Oh, that's a shame. I must say, on contemporary watching, still watching The Musketeers, keeps getting knocked off the air, which is going to really help it. But I don't see its future being much beyond this series, sadly. But there you go.
What are they like? It's going to end up on Netflix or Amazon, isn't it?
Well, I still think they're making mistakes this series. I think, like Doctor Who, they're making the same mistake of trying to entice people in by having running arcs and themes. Mm-hmm. And I'm still not convinced these days that works as well as they think it does. I think if you have a good... If people know what to expect and they like what they get, they will come back.
Well, how many series of Doctor Who have we had now? Was it 8? And how many times has the arc really worked since 2005? It's probably worked 2 or 3 times.
Exactly. That's the problem. It very rarely carries the satisfaction that you desire. While, I hate to go back to it, but, you know, Father Brown is sitting very much on the procedural episodic and not going beyond each week resetting. And, you know, I think there's a lot to be said about that sort of...
Yeah.
And make any changes to format feel special. Those are very occasional ones that you get.
Yeah. Well, speaking of detective dramas,
because
I know you're a Ben Miller fan.
Yes.
Have you been watching Death in Paradise?
I haven't. This is the one, Death in Paradise without Ben Miller.
Yeah.
So as a Ben Miller fan, maybe I would be avoiding it. But your point being taken, yes. No, I've not been watching it. Killing your conversation, clearly.
Well, you see, my question is based on the fact that there seemed to be, when Ben Miller was in it, when his surprise departure occurred, it was quite jarring. But, you know, within a few minutes, it was almost as if his replacement had completely usurped the show. Mm. And Chris Marshall did a very good job of that. And then you also had... Ben Miller's character's relationship with his colleague, played by Sarah Martins, and she's just left the show. I don't know whether it's permanently, or she certainly missed an episode. And that relationship was kind of mirrored with a slightly more affection being displayed by Chris Marshall's character, who was less reserved and more just kind of... He's less kind of stuffy reserved and more just kind of reserved, shy sort of reserved. And I think what I'm getting at is that this is the fourth series and it feels as though it's Chris Marshall's show, which is an achievement for any actor to be able to successfully take over a show and for the storylines to go the way they have done. And I find that kind of strange because, like, you know, I'm a fan of Ben Miller as well. And Death in Paradise was really good with Ben Miller. But I'm finding it strange that Chris Marsh has been able to fit in so easily and for the show to continue so well and survive one, potentially two, major casting changes.
Fascinating. You could take this conversation 50 years back and exchange the names William Hartnell and Patrick Troughton for the two we're doing here, and you could have the same sort of...
Yeah, but of course there's no alien regeneration in this.
No, well, it was a rejuvenation back then as well. I do know your history, Christian Corley.
For goodness sake, you have to be so pedantic.
I'm just saying, I'm just telling you what the text told me.
Oh, well, it wasn't a regeneration then, was it?
It wasn't, no. Yeah, so he's got another regeneration left, yeah. Stephen Moffat didn't work that one out, did he?
Yeah. Moffat. Yeah.
In fact, regeneration wasn't actually noted until the Pertwee regeneration. So he's got another one, yes. That was just a face change. I don't think Katie Price has had a regeneration, has he? And a height change, yes.
Katie Price?
Well, I was thinking, you know, work maybe or maybe not done on their face to change it.
Indeed. Okay, so does that bring us to the end of this week's Castorbis podcast with Kay?
I guess it probably does, I think.
Okay.
Unless you've got anything more to add, I'm sure there's always something to add.
There's always something to add, but at this moment in time, I can't think what it is. If I do, it'll be in the show notes. Until next time, dear listener, thank you for joining this two-handed podcast with a K.
And four-handed.
Until next time, it's goodbye. Hello, my name's James McLean, and I ate a pedant for breakfast. Or a pedant berry. Pedant and warm milk.
I didn't eat. I'd like to see Downtime. I've never seen Downtime.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing it. I wanted to watch Shakedown as well at the time, but, £9 for a video by mail order plus £5.
But you've not watched it on YouTube, because at least Shakedown is on YouTube.
Is Shakedown on YouTube, is it?
It is, yeah. But Downtime isn't.
Downtime's not. Is it on Vimeo?
I have no idea.